Welcome to Police Stories Podcast. This is a series of short stories about my 28 years in the UK police force. Welcome if this is your first time, and welcome back if you've been here before. So this is episode 78, so we're getting on. I hope you've enjoyed it so far, and thanks very much for the downloads again. Very good. Consistent downloads again on YouTube. Thank you. Don't forget you can leave comments on YouTube. Any questions you've got, comments, good or bad, not a problem. Tell me what you're thinking. And also thanks to those that have bought me a coffee so far. You can go on that if you'd like to just show your appreciation, but you absolutely don't have to. No pressure from me. Okay, we'll get on this week then. So this week we're going to talk about, I think in previous episodes, two or three episodes ago, I discussed about custody, you know, the actual cells where you place people that are under arrest. And I was explaining that, you know, the vast majority of forces now have gone over to kind of centralized custodies. So they have very large custody blocks with dedicated staff, both custody sergeants, which is the norm, and also sometimes civilian custody sort of jailers, and also cops, you know, PCs that have stepped in that are sort of playing the jailing role, if you like. And when I say large, you know, certainly both in London and Scotland, you know, you can have three or four floors of cells, and they might have 60 or 80 cells, you know, and there'll be maybe a dozen of those sort of dotted throughout the area, you know, which can be quite a large geographical area. And that's where Scotland struggles a little bit because of the geographical area. Obviously, it is a very large place. Some of it's very remote. And I've explained before that the station I was based on the west coast of Scotland, our nearest sort of big custody centre was probably a 2-hour drive away. And that was along a sort of mountain pass. So anything could happen weather-wise, you know, you could get cut off. The other option was a ferry, but likewise, you know, if you had a storm, you couldn't do that. Now, what would you do, you know, if you had a prisoner, if you had someone in custody you'd arrested, and you just couldn't get to that sort of, you know, that main sort of custody centre, that super custody suite, if you like. And the issue, and basically it was solved, I say solved, you know, it's sort of what they'd done is how it evolved was a lot of the smaller nicks, a lot of the smaller police stations had a few, you know, leftover cells from sort of days gone by. And actually they kind of kept them going really, because for these remote satellite stations, if you had someone arrested, there may not be another choice. The other thing is if you've got a fighter, you know, if you've got someone really in kicking off, there's no way that you can put them in the back of a cell van and then comfortably, you know, drive them 2 hours round, because you'd have to stop the van. You know, they might need a toilet break, and that brings all sorts of nightmares of possible escape on some remote mountain pass somewhere, you know, which you might think it seems unlikely, but, you know, it has happened. So it's not ideal. And also nowadays in this caring, fluffy world that we live in, you know, prisoners' welfare, you know, is very much looked at, you know. A cell van in the back that has a cage in it effectively, and it's pretty small. You know, if one person sat in it, it's only like 1.5 people wide, you know, and just enough space to sort of stretch their legs out. We're not talking massive. Now, if I put you in that, you can't see out sometimes, and then I drive you on a twisty road for 2 hours. A lot of people are actually, you know, throwing up, they're being sick, you know, they're feeling terrible. And if you've got someone who's got medical conditions or maybe has taken drugs or something, you know, realistically, from a prisoner welfare point of view, it's just not going to happen. So the way they got round it was to have these cells that were locally. And in fact, the police station that I was at, which was relatively small, had a lot of cells, you know, from, again, a sort of bit of a bygone era, perhaps. You know, I think we had something like 20 cells, 10 male and 10 female, you know, which was a huge amount, because, you know, you could go a week in that station and not have a single prisoner in, you know, depending on how it worked. Or you could have two a day, you know, it's very, very sort of random. It just depends what investigations are happening. Of course, on a Friday or Saturday night, you expect to have more prisoners, but it didn't always follow like that. And with ongoing investigations that people needed to be arrested and interviewed for, then, you know, it might be that the day sometimes were busier with detectives or uniform cops bringing in various people, you know, for arrest and interview. Now, one of the issues they had that most of these stations, including mine, generally only had one sergeant on, and they weren't always custody trained. Now, I think, as I've explained before, in a lot of places, in fact, in most places, custody, you know, the person who's in charge of custody, if you like, is a sergeant, is a custody sergeant. But they just couldn't achieve that in Scotland in some places. So PCs, normal cops like me, were trained up in that custody officer role. And I did it. It helps, you know, if you've got perhaps a bit of experience, a bit of life experience for sure, but it's not vital. From memory, it was a 2-week course. I think we did 1 week on the IT side of it, and you might think that's really straightforward, but it could be very, very involved, the IT system. And then 1 week actual sort of course, you know, and that included your first aid and various other bits and pieces, going through lots of scenarios and kind of what ifs. Because what would happen is, so we'll talk through the whole process just so you get an idea. Now, I hope this isn't too boring to some people. A lot of people out there won't have ever been arrested, so perhaps won't know what happens. And obviously you do see it on the telly, and sometimes they get it right or similar-ish, but, you know, the actual full process, you know, doesn't make for good telly necessarily. So quite often they kind of, you know, sex it up a bit. So I'm out on patrol and I see someone walking down the street and, you know, they hit someone in the face. So I step out and I arrest them for a straightforward assault, and I take them by the arm. Now, technically, it's not 100% necessary, but the reality is you generally do it because what you're doing is taking someone's liberty away. That's the saying. So to do that and to make it clear to them that they're no longer free to leave, generally, you would take them by the arm at the very least and tell them they're under arrest. At the same time, you would caution them. Now, I'm giving you like a textbook, you know, nice scenario from one of the fluffy training colleges. Of course, we all know it doesn't work like that necessarily, but basically, when you get hold of them, you caution them as soon as you can. Now, that might come, you know, half an hour later, because if you're immediately fighting with them, you don't have to, out of breath in mid-fight, you know, with them swinging punches at you, caution them because they're under arrest. You know, you get them under control, you get them handcuffed, you get them fast-trapped if that's what they need, and then you, you know, give them the caution. Generally, you would tell them what they've been arrested for. That is, you know, very much, you know, a prerequisite really, but again, not entirely necessary. I think most people know, and certainly immediately some people of course protest their innocence, you know, and say it wasn't them or they didn't do that, or come up with a million different you know, sort of different circumstances why that you shouldn't be arresting them. And of course, you know, the very nature of arresting someone and taking someone's liberty and getting hold of their arm can be the catalyst for them kicking off. And that all depends, you know, on the person. But you'd be surprised, you know, like 80% of arrests, you take someone by the arm, you tell them they're under arrest, caution them, and that they're going to be transported to the nearest police station, you know, and that's it. You know, it's there's no sort of kicking off. Generally, they're handcuffed. Not always. You do have to justify that. So if they've been completely calm with you, very reasonable, you might choose not to. That's a bit of a judgment call from the officer. And certainly at the beginning of your shift, what you should have done is search the back of your police car, particularly down like the backs of the seats, maybe, you know, folded the seats forward and had a good look round to make sure that there was nothing in there. Because if you take your prisoner off to custody and then you subsequently search down the back of the seats and find a knife, you know, as long as you've done that search prior to them getting in, you might be able to, you know, put that knife to them and could be charging them ultimately with that. And certainly I've done that before. So the person, let's say they're placed in handcuffs, maybe handcuffed to the rear and placed in the seat. Obviously, they don't get put behind the driver. They get put behind what would be the front passenger seat. And then another cop will sit beside them directly behind the driver. And that's obviously so that they don't get the opportunity to attack the driver. And you might think, well, they're handcuffed to the rear, you know, how are they going to do that? Certainly on some occasions, unfortunately, flexible types are able to effectively step through their own arms and their hands to step out of the cuffs so that the cuffs are now in front of them. And unfortunately, I know of at least one fatality in the UK where a prisoner being transported has then leant forward, and I think it was like 70 miles an hour on the motorway, has ripped up the handbrake of the vehicle, causing it to have what turned out to be a fatal accident for the cop that was driving. So that security is very, very important, you know. And I would say the rest of the country is perhaps a little more relaxed about transporting people and certainly physically laying hands on people. In Scotland, they're really, really hot on hands-on prisoners. And, you know, even when you're in the cell block, so now we've transported them, we've arrived, and we're taking them in. Certainly, I've been to lots of custodies all around the country, and I have been guilty of it as well. If someone seems okay, I don't necessarily take them by the arm. You know, I let them walk in and I walk beside them into the custody area. Scotland, I would say, is the complete opposite. Really hot on it. The moment you step out of that car, at least one cop will have your arm and hold you all the time, if not a cop either side of you. And really, that is the, you know, that is the way to do it. You know, that's the Rolls Royce version. That way people, you know, don't get a chance to do anything silly. So you're led into the custody area and you're taken to what's called the charge bar or the, you know, the custody suite, various things. And you'll have that custody officer, which in this case might be me, or a custody sergeant. And they'll generally be on a large desk that deliberately is quite wide so that the prisoner can't lean across and attack the custody officer. And quite often it's higher as well, so they're kind of looking down at you. And again, that is to stop the prisoner reaching across and grabbing hold of the custody officer. They'll have a computer in front of them. And if you're comfortable, the custody officer might say, should we have those cuffs off then? Have they been okay? Now, that's always a bit of a judgment call, and certainly I've seen it go wrong several times. I've taken in spitting, fighting prisoners, and the custody sergeant has immediately said, let's have those cuffs off then. And you're kind of like, well, he's been fighting quite a bit, Sergeant. He's pretty angry still, you know. And they may say, okay, we'll leave him on for a bit then until he's calmed down. That's the sensible way. Unfortunately, I have seen some sergeants that have immediately said, no, no, it's my custody suite. Let's have those cuffs off. And the problem with that is obvious, you know, potentially they're going to kick off and fight with you. Maybe they won't. I mean, the custody officer's role is to get the person on side to, you know, to work with them. So that little thing can be enough for the person to now like the custody officer and make their life a whole lot easier. Because remember, in an hour's time, I'll be walking out the door, either back on patrol or to do my paperwork. The custody officer might have the rest of their 8 or 10 or 12 hour shift with this person. So you do want them on board. It will make your life a lot easier. So what happens is then in front of the person, the custody officer will ask, why are they here? And you will explain, you know, hi, Sarge, hi, you know, whoever. I was, you know, driving along so-and-so street and I saw this guy step off the curb, cross the road and punch someone in the face who fell to the floor. I then stepped out of my vehicle, went across, got hold of them by the arm, informed them they were under arrest for assault and cautioned them, to which they made no reply. So that's your grounds you're giving the sergeant. Now, when you're a new cop, it's very easy to fluff that up, particularly as chances are Mr. or Mrs. Bad Guy that you're talking about is standing right there and will go shout over you, no, I didn't do that. That's not how it happened. No, he's lying. That's not what happened, you know, and immediately jump in. This isn't the time for investigation. This is purely me giving the grounds to the custody officer for them to decide if they're going to authorise detention. So I explained to them what's happened. And again, the custody officer, good custody officer, will say, look, you know, just calm yourself down. You'll get an interview. You'll get a chance to have your full say. But now is not the time. I've heard those details from the officer and I'm happy that there are grounds to detain you for the purposes of the investigation so that we can expedite the investigation. Certainly in England and Wales, now you have to give slightly extra details as to why, you know, you've taken that person's liberty away. You don't have to in Scotland, although the reality is you do in kind of in a roundabout way anyway. So you explain the grounds to them and then hopefully they will authorise. Now, not always. I'd say in 99% of the cases it'll get authorised. But it might be a sergeant has heard something, doesn't like the sound of it, or custody officer and says, sorry, I'm not happy. I'm not granting those grounds. And basically that's it. The person's back out the door and you're releasing them onto the street. Very, very rare, I would say. Ideally, that person has been searched when you first arrest them before they get put in the car. That's what you want. But sometimes, you know, if you're in a crowd situation, if this person has just, I don't know, punched a woman in the face in front of six guys who are all her friends, you can imagine you need to get that person away. If you leave them on the street and stand there and take your time and doing a nice little fluffy search, you know, chances are you're going to be attacked by that lot and so is the prisoner. So the common sense approach is I'm throwing them in the car, I'm getting them to the Nick, and then I'm going to search them. So you have to, you know, have this sort of flexible approach to how you're going to deal with things. So, yes, ideally we've searched them there. Now, searching is always a difficult one because searching on the street or even searching in custody initially, which is a bit more controlled, we're not talking about strip searches. There are different types of search, and we'll talk about those in a minute. Your standard search, you know, is hands-on. You're feeling under collars. You're feeling in armpits. You're putting your hands around the person's thigh and calf, you know, and sliding your hands up and down to make sure nothing's concealed. You might be rolling down socks. Shoes are coming off. They're getting sort of tapped on their heel, so anything drops out, and you're looking physically inside them and on the bottom of the sole. There is a set way of doing it, and it's something you become second nature to you, and you get taught it, you know, at police training college, and you'll do it so often, you'll become pretty good at it. But if it's not a strip search, you know, it's not always perfect, and certainly stuff can get missed. Now, I have certainly missed at least one thing that I know about. I had a call down to a very irate custody sergeant once who wanted me to explain why he went down to check on the prisoner to find them smoking a cigarette. Because not only had I missed the cigarette that I don't know where they'd had tucked, but also the lighter they had on them, which could have been a lot more serious. But the reality is, if you're not doing a strip search, if you've put that in like the crutch of your underwear, I'm not going to feel it. So you could have a lighter and a cigarette in there, you know. So I took my medicine, you know, I took the telling off. But the reality is, you know, without that sort of full strip search, stuff could get missed. Now, there's been some horror stories for sure around that. Certainly when I was down south, I knew of a guy that was taken into custody there. And when you get to someone's pockets, what I used to do is I would take hold of their wrist and then say to them, can you empty that pocket? So I'm holding the wrist just in case they pulled a knife or something out of it. And they then took, you know, their change and their wallet and their phone or whatever out and put it on the top while I held their wrist. I mean, if I'm honest, that didn't always happen. And again, you're trying to gauge the person. Is that a reasonable person? I then get them to, you know, turn out the inside of their pocket so I can see there's no more before I'm physically sort of checking the pocket myself, particularly the pocket in jeans. I don't know what you call it, like a condom pocket or whatever it is. The tiny little one that's sort of on your right hip, you know, that's very small, just inside the actual pocket itself. That's a classic for putting in drugs or something. But some people, and I've seen it, and I have done it myself as well, the cuff's come off, the person's been all right, and you say to them, do you want to turn out your pockets, mate? Just stick everything you've got in your pockets on the top there, and then we'll go through it. And on this one occasion down south, basically this guy, you know, started unloading the stuff, and the custody sergeant was happily, you know, dealing with the stuff that was there. So he was like, okay, one pen, one mobile phone, you know, £3.56 in change, one loaded sawn-off shotgun. He'd taken a sawn-off shotgun out from inside of his pocket that he had a special pocket where he cut a hole in it so it slid down inside the length of his leg. He had a sawn-off shotgun in there which was loaded, which he took out and placed on top of the custody desk, pointing at the sergeant. So there was this mad panic while, you know, it was dived on and made safe. And unfortunately, there was a terrible case as well in Croydon down in the Met, where a guy had been arrested and he actually had a revolver concealed. And when it came to the search stage, I don't know the full details, I'm sure you can find it online, the guy produced this pistol and fired shots, I think two of which hit the custody sergeant and killed him. So it's a really serious thing. Again, if you look on YouTube or whatever, you'll see horrible examples of people that have been searched that suddenly produce a knife or something. So it's a very dangerous time and you need to be aware of it. Of course, the next level is the strip search. And, you know, that has to be another level. It's not a norm at all. There has to be believed or perceived knowledge that they may have something concealed further than the norm, i.e. just in their, you know, jeans pocket. If you've had previous dealings with a person, you know they've concealed drugs, you know, in sort of body orifices, then that would be enough. Likewise, if there was intelligence suggesting the person always, you know, wore a shoulder holster with a knife tucked up in his armpit, you know, or whatever it is, you need that little bit of extra concern to then take that to a higher level. And certainly the custody sergeant, or in some cases an inspector, will give you the authority for a strip search. Now, you know, don't be under any illusion. these are really unpleasant to do for the officers. They're obviously same-sex search, and that can sometimes cause a problem, you know, in this modern world we live in with people identifying as all sorts of things. But generally, you know, it would be a male, or it would be two or three male cops searching, you know, a male. Likewise, only females would search a female. And unfortunately, the process, it used to be you basically took them off down to the cell, stripped them naked, you know, and searched them like that. It's got perhaps slightly better or different, depending on your thoughts. Now that, you know, you'd get them down to maybe their boxer shorts and, you know, their T-shirt, they would take their T-shirt off. You would search, you know, their armpits or whatever. Then they would put their T-shirt back on before the underwear comes off. So rather than standing there completely sort of stark naked, there's a little bit of dignity left. But unfortunately, the really unpleasant bit then for blokes is that once they've taken their underwear off, you need them to firstly hold their bits and pieces out of the way. Anything dangling needs to be held to one side so that you can check to make sure nothing's concealed. And then secondly, they need to squat. And unfortunately, somebody, a cop, has to have the job of squatting down behind them to actually check that there is nothing sticking out of their anus. You know, that's the reality of it. And certainly I've carried out a number of strip searches and have had things sticking out of people's backsides. I also had a guy once I arrested for on suspicion of theft, where a receptionist at an office block, her purse had been stolen, and that had, like, you know, some credit cards in and driving license, what have you. We'd recovered the purse, we'd got the guy on description, and we'd taken him back to the cells for a strip search because we'd found everything near him but nothing on him, but there was a credit card outstanding. And when we got down to the strip search, there, tucked neatly on the very inside of his groin beside his bits and pieces, was a credit card in this receptionist's name, tucked to one side. So he was absolutely bang to rights. And up until that point, he'd protested his innocence wildly until we produced this. And then he just kind of, excuse me, just chuckled and sort of said, well, you've got to give it a go, haven't you? You know, so it's a very real reason to do that, for sure. And normally what happens, or what can happen, is invariably the male that is being searched will, you know, spend the entire time accusing you of being, you know, rapists and paedophiles, and that you're all gay, and you only want to look, you know, up his bum and all the rest of it, and just generally giving you a hard time. Some of that is because they're genuine feeling. Some of that is because with young cops, they feel they can intimidate them, and that they might just want to hurry up and miss something. What we've also seen, and they call it different things in different areas, but certainly plugging or banking is two of the terms that I've heard. Guys out there, and girls as well, I'm sure, deliberately get themselves arrested on a Friday night. They'll go and smash a window or hit something or do something in front of a cop, basically, to guarantee their arrest. Because they know that when they go back to the cells, as long as they get away with a non-strip search, or if they've been particularly sort of careful in their concealment, they'll have concealed high-value drugs, certainly, you know, sort of perhaps low-value drugs on the street, but high-value drugs in prison, up inside themselves. Because they know that getting arrested on a Friday night with no court on a Saturday, and the next court is Monday, chances are they're getting remanded and going to prison, and then they'll get produced for court on Monday. But they also know that to make some quick money, if they end up in the prison system with something, some drugs concealed inside themselves, they've got the weekend to then sell these drugs in prison before they come out, and they can make a lot of money. So you see that a lot, and we used to have the same characters pulling that trick all the time. So on a strip search, you'd be very careful. And one of the things they used to do, sometimes they put things in condoms and then force them up their backsides. Other times they'd use, I don't know if you're aware of the Kinder Egg, which is like a chocolate egg they sell, I think all around the world, but certainly in the UK, it's like a chocolate egg, a child's, you know, sort of sweet. And then within that egg is a very rounded, almost sort of bullet-shaped plastic container that has a small toy in for the child, where they would get these Kinder Eggs, get the sort of rounded plastic insert that would normally have the toy in it, they would put all their drugs in it and then lube it up, and that would be inserted into themselves. That was a good way of them carrying, you know, quite a large amount of drugs, which they would then get into prison and make themselves quite a bit of money. And these sorts of people were getting arrested, you know, 2-3 times a week. They didn't care that they were, you know, getting charged with some damage to a window or whatever, because they just made 500 quid, you know, off the drugs they'd sold that weekend. And as I say, it wasn't unusual for this to happen, you know, twice a week or something. It really did go on. But so being a custody officer, once they're produced and they've had their search, there's a series of questions, certainly in Scotland, I think it's like 21 questions or 20 questions or something like that, that are asked of the person. And they range from, you know, have you ever been in custody before? Do you feel okay? You know, do you have a mental health history? Are you a drug user? Are you an alcoholic? All important things, obviously, if you're intending to look after that person's welfare. And quite often it might become apparent that they've done something maybe called parachuting, which, again, knowing that they're coming into custody, you know, they might know that they're going to be arrested, depending on what they've done, and therefore they will take drugs themselves so that they're very, very high when they come in, knowing that they might get through the door perhaps, and then the next sort of 8 hours in their cell will be passed because they'll be high as a kite. Very, very dangerous from a custody officer's point of view. And the last thing you want to do is end up with a death in custody, because, you know, that is a whole lot of grief, apart from the fact someone's died as well. But it's also a very difficult time. Then there's a massive investigation. It's a huge deal that. So they'll come in and seem okay, put them in the cells. They'll spend the next 8 hours absolutely high as a kite. But any concerns that the custody officer has, they will send them off to hospital. And that's very sort of resource intensive, because the person has to go with at least two cops. You know, busy A&Es, you can't just walk in, accident, emergency, you can't just walk in and demand to see someone, so you might have to wait your turn. So it's not uncommon for cops to go out there, and I've certainly spent 5, 6, 8, 10 hours at hospital waiting with my prisoner to be seen before they look at him and say, no, he's fine, he's fit to detain, here, give him, you know, this whatever drug it is, and he's fine, take him back to the cells. Other occasions, you'll get a police surgeon, as they call him, to actually come out to the cell and deal with the person in the cell. But depending on where you are and the geography, you know, it might just be easier to take them up the A&E to get them checked out. So all these questions go in, that builds up a good picture of who this person is, and then you're able to look after them. And as a custody officer, you have to make a decision, you know, how regularly am I going to check this person? Now, if you have no concerns at all, it might be hourly. That's about as long as you'd go, maybe hourly checks. But that can be anything then, you know, it can be cut down a half hourly, 15 minutes, or as we talked about, I think it was last week, constant watches where the cell door is open and a cop is sat in the door of the cell, you know, sort of looking and speaking to this person. Or alternatively, they're put into a camera cell where the cops will just look, sit there and look at the camera the whole time watching this person. Their dignity is protected just out of interest. There's a little block on the monitor, like a solid black block on the monitor around the toilet. So the person can go to the toilet and you can't actually see, you know, their intimate parts. So that protects their dignity. And then really, the decision is made as to what's happening with these people. So they might be interviewed, they might be charged, they might be held for court. There are various things. And you get everything ranging from the prisoners. You know, I've had some right characters in. You can have a real laugh with some of them. Invariably, they want, you know, a tea or a coffee or a pot noodle, or you feed them. The food's rubbish. Tea and coffee's even worse. But invariably, if you keep them on side, we used to take them out for a smoke break in like the exercise yard. That was always popular. Most Nicks are now non-smoking. So it makes it more difficult, but still maybe you could take them out for a swift, you know, sneaky cigarette, because again, it will make your life a lot easier, and that's what it's all about. And other times they'll spend the next 2 hours, you know, being sick, smashing the cell door, shouting and screaming because they're drunk and they've been fighting when they come in, excuse me, and everything in between. So it's quite a busy, interesting place, custody. All sorts of characters have turned up. One particularly at my last station that I used to see quite regularly, and he always made me chuckle. He was very polite, no issues at all, very friendly. His background was that he'd, I think in the sort of 90s and noughties and the 2000s, he'd been a very good sort of music producer and had been very wealthy at one point. But unfortunately, he got into the drug scene quite heavily, and for sure, it basically cooked his brain. You know, he was a very interesting character, to say the least, with all sorts of issues, did some very strange things. But regularly, when he came into custody, you'd have to always do a strip search on him because he would always conceal stuff on him. Not weapons, just strange things. And you're probably wondering what sorts of strange things. Well, his favourite trick was when you did a strip search on him, he had a piece of string tied around his penis. And then hanging down from that was a small piece of circuit board, computer circuit board. And you'd always say to him, "Why have you got this on you?" And he would tell you, you know, it was to stop the radio waves, you know, entering his body that the government were using against him. So he was a fairly messed up individual. It wasn't uncommon for him to strip naked, and he'd happily sit in his cell naked, exercising bizarrely. And also, I would go down like to do my hourly checks on him, look through the peephole to find him naked, doing a handstand in the cell, you know, and you'd open the hatch and shout, "You all right?" And he'd be like, "Yeah, no problems." Very friendly, very polite, you know, and you'd be like, "Do you want a cup of tea?" Like, "Yeah, sure." You'd kind of be walking away down the corridor thinking, this is bizarre. You know, I'm having this conversation with a naked guy doing a handstand, and you'd kind of be walking thinking, what have I let myself in for? What sort of job is this? There must be easier ways of earning money. It did always used to make me chuckle when dealing with him. But there we go. Okay, well, I hope you found that interesting. I say, a lot of you may have never been in custody, so perhaps won't know the procedure necessarily, but hopefully that will give you a bit of an insight. Okay, thanks very much for listening. Speak to you again next week. Take it easy. Cheers. Bye.